Welcome to Modern Church History. I'm Teresa Holman, and I'm here with Father Michael Witt. Welcome, Father.
Thank you, Teresa. Hello.
Hello. Back again. Show number 24. We just finished all the German and French and English warring amongst themselves, and I guess amongst themselves in their own countries, really not amongst each other.
Pretty much so, yeah. Yeah. It was pretty much of a free-for-all, but they tend to do it nation by nation.
So we're hopefully out of that for a little while. We got a little breathing room.
Yes, we do. Okay. Yeah, yeah. There's a point in time. You know, 1648 is often considered to be one of the watersheds of history, Western history. A lot of courses, interestingly enough, modern general histories will start in 1648 or end in 1648. Textbooks will always, so many textbooks will end a chapter with 1648. So there's something really significant. I think all of us ever since then, looking back on the history of this period, would say that 1648, which is the date of the Treaty of Westphalia, is a real watershed. It's one of those, although we have to always keep in mind that while that's well, the military and religious thing is going on, there's lots of other things going on, too. As we mentioned last time around, a lot of scientific discoveries are underway. A lot of philosophical considerings are underway. The Baroque era, the arts, music is all underway. The architecture is all developing. And some of that is in reaction to the experience on the battlefield. We'll be talking especially about one thinker who was heavily influenced by the experiences of the battlefield and of the riots and rebellions throughout this century, that being Thomas Hobbes.
Okay.
But I think probably the one we'd want to really start out with the as we look back over what has happened and as we look at the current era would be one of our own contemporaries, Rodney King. Do you remember Rodney King out in Los Angeles?
Yes.
You know, after all those riots and everything, and what did he say to the press? Can we all live together?
Get along. Right? Can we just get along?
Yeah. And the conclusion of many people of that area, that age, you know, in the mid-17th century is no, we can't. not if we're going to let religion be our guiding light. And this is then what happens is this shift that really takes place, seeing religion as part of the problem rather than part of the solution. All historians, all church historians recognize this. And once again, look back at 1648 as being that shift. Thomas Bachenkotter, who has done this huge history, one-volume history of the church, as he observes this, he says, let me just give you a little couple quotes that he has. He says, and they're just really indicative. You know, first of all, he says, thought, you know, the progress of thought would no longer originate within the Christian churches. I think he's really overstating that, and we'll show and prove later on that spirituality and the development of the spiritual life is very, very much alive, especially in the Catholic Church. And there are also wonderful things happening in Protestant denominations. People like Wibbenfort standing up against slavery, the Wesley brothers trying to make methodical religion and as a result Methodism. So there's going to be a lot of development taking place in the churches. But for a church historian to make that statement, there has to be something going on with that. He also mentions, he says, that minds, you know, the finest intellects, are quite alienated from the church. I think it's an overstatement once again, but for him to make that statement, he has to have something to go on there.
Right.
And then he also mentions that principles are arrived at by reason and by social experience. That is certainly true. Now, as much as one might critique Bachenkotter as Bachenkotter critiques religion in the 17th century, another historian weighs in very strongly, also Alan Schreck. You know, and his small history of the church. He's got that little concise history of the church. He mentions that there are four very basic shifts or trends that take place around the same period. And I'll just mention those two, because we're going to have to look at those in some detail. They really are the elements of what makes up modern society.
Okay.
Okay. First of all, he mentions the emergence of science and technology.
Mm-hmm.
And even today, we have a tendency, and we've had for the last several hundred years, of making that one word, science and technology.
Right.
It really is two very different things.
Uh-huh.
And I hope in the upcoming programs, we can talk about the interplay of the two of them.
Oh, that'd be great.
In their development. They're very interesting. But they have science and technology will have an incredible hold on the Western mind.
Mm-hmm.
We will, as one historian has pointed out, we are going to be turning, instead of turning to God for truth, we'll be turning to science for truth.
Mm-hmm.
And we will be awaiting the blessings, not of God, but the blessings of technology. In the end, and it takes us 400 or 500 years, but in the end, we will realize, well, maybe we won't realize, but some of us realize, that those are lesser gods.
Right.
And there's a whole bunch of lesser gods that emerge after this chaos of these sectarian wars. And science is going to be one of those lesser gods. Technology is going to be one of those lesser gods. The state,
mm-hmm.
the nation
mm-hmm.
state, is going to be a lesser god. It's going to be a very demanding god also. Reason is mm-hmm. going to be, and philosophy is going to be a lesser god. And then we'll just see, and commerce, and just a whole bunch. People give their souls. Modern Westerners give their souls over to many other things besides Jesus Christ and the God that Jesus brings us to, the Father. And I think to our detriment.
Yes.
You know, what we find in the next several centuries, and particularly in this previous century, the 20th century, is incredible pain and suffering, and it's been so much so that we don't even realize it.
Right, that's true.
That's mm-hmm. it. And a lot of this has its beginnings here in 1648.
Wow.
He also mentions the development of new philosophy.
Okay.
Which we want to go into and take quite a good look at, too. I want to take a look at Francis Bacon
mm-hmm.
and the scientific method that he will popularize, and then the use of doubt in order to dispel cynicism, and that with René Descartes.
Mm-hmm.
And so we'll take a look at both of them. Human reasoning being used to determine the truth of all things. Okay. Third thing that Alan Schreck points out is the political experiments, that we are, for the first time, willing to experiment with political institutions. George Washington even says that as he refers to the United States toward the end of his life. He reflects back and calls what happens in the United States, in the Constitution of the United States, as being the great experiment.
Mm-hmm.
You know, that's gutsy stuff. And that happens to be, I'm a little biased on this, but that mm-hmm. happens to be a successful experiment.
Right.
On the other hand, what develops over in France with the French Revolution is a monster. The great experiment of the Marxist Revolution of 1917 is a monster.
Mm-hmm.
The National Socialist experiment of 1933 with Adolf Hitler is a monster.
Mm-hmm.
So most political experiments, I would say, that in the last 400 years have been terrible disasters. We happen to have one of the more mild successes.
Mm-hmm.
You know? But nonetheless, this is something that people are willing to enter into in this new modern era. And then the fourth trend that Schreck speaks of is secularization. It's literally the removal of religion from the public sphere. And these are all going to be forces that are going to be underway. And if we look back over what we experienced, what we've talked about in the 16th and 17th century, with so much bloodshed mm-hmm. and so much sectarian strife and the disintegration of a common understanding of what is truth, you know, that medieval synthesis has totally been shattered. You can see where you have the entry into the possibility of looking for another kind of solution. Rodney King's question still is plaguing mankind. You know, can we live together? And if the answer is yes, we have to, then the next is the method. How do we do that? Mm-hmm. And so we'll be looking for ways of bringing that about. Okay. The first person I think we really need to turn to and look at who comes up with an answer is Thomas Hobbes.
Okay.
Englishman, soldier. Lives from 1588 to 1679. And his opus magnus is the book Leviathan. The book itself is known, very seldom read, and with good reason. It is very hard to plod through it.
Okay.
Huge, huge sentences that run on and on, and huge, huge paragraphs that boggle your mind. You go, what on earth is he saying? But he's got little gems in this, and his basic argument is so important for us to consider that we have to plod through. Some people have to plod through that book in order to distill it. He names the book after the Old Testament master of chaos. Leviathan is the sea creature of chaos.
Okay.
Now, the book comes out in 1651, and the bottom line on this argument, Hobbes' argument, is that human nature is fallen and corrupt.
Okay.
He does not use theology to prove that. He doesn't go back to the book of Genesis to prove that. He uses the empirical. He says, look around you. You know, several people have mentioned, you know, that if there's any doctrine that does not have to be proven and even preached by the church is the doctrine of original sin. All you have to do is look around you, and you can see it all over the place. And that's what he will argue, is that human nature is fallen, is corrupt, and with freedom and license, if you allow people to go about on their own, what you're going to end up with is murder, rape, sodomy, brutality, all the terrible things. And again, he doesn't have to prove this philosophically or from Scripture.
Right.
He goes right to the events. He looks at the age of these terrible wars. And, of course, standing out in all of our minds is what happens on those two terrible days in France on the St. Bartholomew Day Massacre.
Mm-hmm.
You know? His argument then is that the only hope for mankind, you know, Rodney King, can we all live together? And Hobbes says yes. Now, here's my method, is an absolute state, an overpowerful state that will protect people from people. Mm-hmm. That's the answer.
Mm-hmm.
One of his quotes, and I'll just give you a little bit of this to give you a flavor of the difficulty of understanding what he's saying, but the importance of what he says. He talks about what he calls the first law of nature. And Hobbes says that every man ought to endeavor peace as far as he has hopes of obtaining it. And when he cannot obtain it, then he may seek and use all helps and advantages of war. So his argument is this, that the first law of nature is that we should live with peace, at peace with each other. But if we determine that we cannot live at peace, then we must bring about war so terrible as to make it end quickly. In other words, kill your enemy right away, and then you'll be at peace. Well, that's pretty brutish.
Yes.
But if it's the state that's doing it, then it's legitimate, you know. So he looks to secular rulers to guide. That's going to be the answer. He's not going to look to the church and church influences. He looks around and he sees in Germany, the Pope is treated as a foreign ruler, ignored. You know, the Inquisitions in Spain, he sees nothing helpful in that. In France, Richelieu, Mazarin, building of this absolutist state. There is one thinker in all of this. His name is Hugo Grotius, in which he is going to argue that nations have laws themselves, that there be a law for nations and international society. So he's looking beyond the nation itself and arguing that there is a nation of nations, you know, and that this needs to come about. But the absolutist state is not going to accept that at mm-hmm. this point. The absolutist state is going to be absolute in and of itself. And certainly the church, from that point of view, is reduced to the level of a cabinet ministry. If you can imagine the Secretary of Church Affairs or Secretary of Religious Affairs would share office space with the Director of Park and Recreation.
Yeah, right.
You know, that's where an absolutist state is going to be.
Mm-hmm.
One of the things that I think that Hobbes makes the most eloquent argument for is for capital punishment. And to understand it from his point of view is to understand the importance of capital punishment in an absolutist state.
Uh-huh. Right?
In other words, that this state, this nation state, has no boundaries at all.
Right.
Now, one of the things he'll point out is that the one thing, and I think he's ultimately he's wrong on this, because he assumes that in human nature, that the one thing that we all hold in common, the one thing that we cherish more than anything else, is our own individual life. I would have said that was true until September 11th.
Mm-hmm.
And we know now that there are people who are willing to kill many other people and die in the process of doing that themselves.
Mm-hmm.
His argument was founded or grounded on the concept that the only thing that we absolutely fear and that the state absolutely has over us is extinction, is non-life.
Mm-hmm.
And so the state always maintains that as the ultimate punishment, the ultimate stick, right?
Mm-hmm.
And in that, especially in murder cases, it is absolutely important that the absolute state take the absolute step of absolutely abolishing your existence if you murder someone else.
Mm-hmm.
Because only the state has the right to deny life to one of its citizens.
Not you.
Get that,
huh? Right.
And if you violate that, then a jealous state must take the step of ending your life also. So that's the basis behind capital punishment. And it's also the basis behind something that seems as innocuous as dueling. The laws mm-hmm. against dueling are introduced, many of them resulting from Thomas Hobbes' ideas. Because Hobbes is going to argue that here's an interesting argument for us. Talk about the whole question of constitutional privacy,
uh-huh,
you know,
uh-huh.
Okay, which we can apply to like Roe v. Wade,
right?
Okay, or more recently the rulings from the Supreme Court on what you do in your own bedroom.
Right.
Here you have a situation clearly in the 17th century where two men would have an altercation over some item. It might be over a love affair. It might be over a gambling debt. It could be over anything. But the two of them decide to settle this on their own. And so they go out to a field or they go out to an island someplace. And under very clear sets of rules, the two of them then will duel to the death. They might take pistols, for instance, and they'll have seconds, people who will act as their assistants. And then they'll go out there and they'll settle this in a gentlemanly way. Can't show you this on the radio, but I've just done quotation marks.
Uh-huh.
A gentlemanly way. Now, what's wrong with that? You know, these are two consenting adults
uh-huh.
going to do something that they both consent to, and they understand the consequences, and they learn anything into it. What right does the state have to come and stop that?
Right.
Okay. Hobbes will argue that the state has the right to do that because theoretically, from the theory, no person has the right to deny the life of another person. Only the state has that right. Get the
mm-hmm,
idea?
Mm-hmm.
So it's kind of an interesting contemporary
uh-huh.
point of view. Hobbes will never really become one of the great philosophers of Western civilization, but his influence on political science and on his influence on the development of these kinds of absolutist states is tremendous and essential to our understanding of this development of these states. When we look particularly at the highest example of this development, which is Louis XIV's state, we're going to see the application of Hobbesian concepts.
Okay.
These concepts will continue off and on all the way down. I remember very distinctly in the 1970s, I had the opportunity, this was in the early mid-70s, this was in the mid-70s, visiting Washington, D.C. with a group of students on what was at the time called a close-up program. You go and you study the government in action.
Oh, okay.
It was a fascinating study, but what struck me the most was, I was a young history teacher at the time, was that a lot of government officials were walking around with copies of Leviathan.
Really?
Which I found to be really interesting. And the quoting from Leviathan, which I found to be really interesting because, I mean, this guy's, you know, writing hundreds of years earlier. But it had to do with, if you remember, during the Nixon administration, there was a question of whether or not a government could break its own laws. And the argument was, by these government officials, that a government could break its own laws in order to preserve the law, that the government can go outside of the law to preserve the law. It has that right. Other officials, particularly the Judiciary Committee in the Senate, had argued, no, that can't be done. And you have to work within the constitutional boundaries. If you want to change things, change the Constitution. And so there you had Hobbes being brought into a great constitutional battle of the 1970s,
uh-huh,
of the strength of the federal government, particularly the executive branch, in exerting itself beyond the Constitution of the United States, doing things that were clearly unconstitutional and illegal, and then arguing, based on Hobbes, that they did this in order to preserve the government itself.
Do you think Hobbes' Leviathan would have supported that?
Yes, it does. Leviathan supports that.
I kind of assumed that.
Yeah, that's right. But there you have the example of a lesser god.
Uh-huh.
People who are willing to place
the state above everything.
That's exactly right.
Even above itself.
Even above its own rules.
Uh-huh.
Yeah, that's
uh-huh.
right. Yeah. So Hobbes plays a terribly important role, not always positive role, but
mm-hmm.
a terribly important role in answering Rodney King's question,
mm-hmm.
can we live together? How do we do that? Well, give all power over to the absolutist state, or now in the 20th century we refer to it as a totalitarian state.
Right. Mm-hmm.
Yeah. There are other answers also to all of this, and some of this comes in the by way of philosophy and science and technology. So why don't we go ahead and begin talking a little bit about those guys also?
Sounds great.
Okay. Quite honestly, we have to understand that in the 17th century that there is a considerable spiritual bankruptcy due to sectarian argument and splintering, wars and riots and anarchy. You know, where is the moral authority?
Right.
Where is truth? Where is certitude? Where can you find this? And you'll have thinkers at this period who have lots of influence who will be basically saying, there isn't any. There is no such thing as certitude. There is no such thing as objective truth. There is no moral authority. Probably the best known is a Frenchman by the name of Montaigne.
Uh-huh.
Lives from 1533 to 1592, so he has a good number of years to have some influence over people. And his constant theme was the question, Qu'est-ce? How do I know? How do I know? Or even more, how do you know? You know, this is really the foundation of modern skepticism.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
Because the implication of that answer is, de rien, nothing.
Right.
I don't know anything. What do you know? Don't know anything. You're going to have agnostics. And they're going to range from people like Montaigne,
uh-huh,
all the way through to these other people who are running around and being believed by many people like Nostradamus,
uh-huh,
who is a historical character. He's a real character, Fascinating life, has some very strange things happen. He was trained as a physician, if I remember correctly. He was a doctor. And early in his practice, I forget the particulars of his life, but early in his practice, he had to predict a development, a medical development, and he did. And then with that, he had several other rather notorious predictions that he made, and he gained quite a reputation. Mm-hmm. And then, of course, he's famous for these little canticles that he came up with that are still floating around today. Mm-hmm. They are so nebulous that they could apply to anybody at any time. And so the same canticles that are applied to, for instance, Adolf Hitler during the 1930s, Nostradamus was often quoted saying, look, it's right there, it's right there. Those same quotes are now used for Osama bin Laden.
Mm-hmm.
The destruction of the two towers in September 11th of 2001 can be read into his quotes. You know, I remember just after September 11th, somebody came up with this. Oh, Nostradamus predicted this. Well, wait a second. You know, 15 years ago, he had been used, those same quotes had been used concerning the earthquake in Los Angeles. But he's not alone. There are others who are running around with this esoteric knowledge and making quite a scene. There's a lot of fanaticism that's mm-hmm. also going on during this period. So in other words, what happens is that there's a moral vacuum.
Right.
Okay?
Uh-huh.
And so moral vacuums, nature abhors vacuums. It's going to fill that vacuum with something. I'll give you a real current example of this in the 20th century. In 1891, Pope Leo XIII promulgated an encyclical, Rerum Novarum.
Mm-hmm.
And he very clearly, read that, he very clearly says, this is the way we should conduct ourselves as a civil society in the modern world. And people did not listen to him.
Mm-hmm.
And so he wanted to fill this moral vacuum with this vision of what the 20th century could have been like. Instead, the moral vacuum is filled with people, the thoughts of people like Adolf Hitler, of Benito Mussolini, Joseph Stalin, Vladimir Lenin, you know, mm-hmm. and we see what happened, what that century looked like.
Right.
And same thing is also happening now in Europe at the same time. Nobody is not I can't say nobody, but a lot of people are not paying attention to the churches. Because they disagree with each other.
Mm-hmm.
And
mm-hmm.
they talk about the same thing. They all talk about God, but they understand it differently.
Right.
They talk about Jesus Christ, they understand it differently. They talk about the Eucharist, they understand it differently, you know. And so another force that comes into this vacuum is fanaticism.
Mm.
And that includes things like witch trials.
Oh, okay.
Oh my,
that's
this
right.
was the age of burning people,
right.
especially women.
Right.
And unfortunately, a terrible setback to Western medicine, burning herbalists.
Mm-hmm.
Many of these women were just experts at herbalism, which goes back to the ancient times, back to Celtic traditions, back to Germanic traditions, back to the Romans, to the Greeks. And we lost so much of their wisdom, which has luckily been redeemed. Much of it has been redeemed through modern herbal studies. But so much of that was lost for centuries because of the burning of herbalists and women as witches. As late as 1692, we still have over here in the Western Hemisphere the burning of 20 women in the Massachusetts Bay Colony.
Mm-hmm.
The last woman to be burned on a witch charge that we have in recorded history was in Scotland in 1722.
Wow.
Yeah, that's, 60 years, 50 years before the American Revolution.
Right.
So, records show that as much as 1% of the population of Scotland was burned at the stake for witchery. 1%.
Wow. That is
incredible.
Enormous.
Yeah.
That was just...
So,
scary time.
You know, where do you make sense of all of this? There are two historians who are real standard fare for modern historians. They wrote a book many years ago, back in the 50s and 60s, called The History of the Modern World. It's R.R. Palmer and Joel Colton. Palmer is from St. Louis. He was a professor of history at Washington University. Colton from Duke University. And this particular book has gone through many, many editions. I believe it was back, the first one was in 1950, and it's been published ever since then. It's a real standard, Palmer and Colton, and you can pick this up. Unfortunately, you can pick it up at book fairs. I don't know if it's even available currently, but you can pick it up for 50 cents at a book fair.
Wow.
And it is one of the most thorough going books that's going to cover the modern world, basically from around this period up. They had a very telling quote in one of their chapters about science. And I'd just like to read you that quote.
Okay.
It says an awful lot, I think, about us as a modern people. It says this. And remember, we're asking the question, where do we make sense out of this? If we're not going to accept skepticism and agnosticism, if we're going to try to find some meaning in all of this, and they said it's going to be science.
Mm-hmm.
And this is the quote. It says, "Science in time provides Europe with new faith in itself. The rise of science in the 17th century possibly saved European civilization from petering out in a long post-medieval afterglow, are from wandering off into diverse paths of genial skepticism, ineffectual philosophizing, desultory magic, or mad fear of the unknown." And in fact, there are experiments which each one of these, the mad fear of the unknown, the burning it, of herbalists and women at the stake, this magic thing. Well, Nostradamus and all of his guys, ineffectual philosophizing. Well, I don't know. I'm no philosopher, but a great deal of the stuff that's done over the next couple hundred years just doesn't make a lot of sense. And it's a lot of anguish from very anguished people. Genial skepticism. Well, we're going to see lots of skepticism in people and lots of very ugly answers that don't mean a lot to humanity, makes sense. And you know, so there are all of those possibilities. I really question this first sentence that Palmer and Colton have. Though. They said, "Science in time provides Europe with new faith in itself." New faith in itself. Itself meaning new faith in Europe and Western thought? Or is it new faith in science? They're not clear on that. And I think in both of those cases, they're asking a bit too much out of science.
Mm-hmm.
You will have an adoration of science and the expecting of blessings of technology, as we mentioned before. But we need to step back a bit and see how it is that science comes in to take this overarching position in the mind of Westerners or in the mind of Europeans, of thinkers, you know, because we look to science for all of these answers. How did this come about?
Mm-hmm.
And so let's go ahead and do a real fast running through this. I'm going to introduce a big German word in all of this, and the word is Weltanschauung.
Okay.
Okay. It means a world view.
Okay.
An Anschauung in German is what happens when you go to the top of a peak. You know, you're up on top of a mountain, and you look out over to the north, down into the valley, and there's a castle over on the right, and you see that. Okay, that's your view. It's a beautiful view. And then you reverse that. You look in another direction, and you look to the south, and the Alps are there, and you see nothing but snow-capped peaks and mountains and no trees, no growth, nothing, no human community. Okay, so that's one view. There's another view. And so that's an Anschauung, a Weltanschauung, is a world view. So this is how people look at the world. One day you get up, and and you look at the world and you see the world as being this beautiful garden in which God is there watching out for you, and your prayers are heard by God, and His angels are with you, and life is not always easy. There's tough things in life, but God's always with you through this, and you have the community of saints around you, so that if you lose a coin, you pray to Saint Anthony, and when you go to bed that night, you go to bed with a certain confidence in knowing that if you're called by God that night, that you'll be with Him in heaven the next day, God willing, that you live, and you try to live a good life to merit that, you know. And then the next day you wake up, okay? And the next day you wake up in the morning and you look around and you go, oh, the sun came up. Now the sun is a great big, huge, burning nuclear bomb in the sky. Oh boy, okay, but it's going to bring us heat. And well, I've got to get up and I got to go and do this work, because in order to get money so that I can provide food for myself, I need to go and somebody else is my boss and I better watch out. And then, you know, you go through that day just worrying about where your food's going to come from, where your fuel's going to come from, how you can make more money so that you can buy a nice Lexus rather than the little VW you've been driving around in, and so you're all concerned about that. And before you go to bed that night, you take a look at the nightly business report to see whether your stock portfolio went up or went down. And then you go to bed and you think to yourself, oh, gee, oh, if I die tonight, that's it. That's it. And I won't have an opportunity to enjoy that new Lexus I just bought.
Mm-hmm.
Well, that's it. Now, that is a world change. That is a Weltanschauung change.
Huh? Right, you know? Definitely.
And this is what happens in that century, is that there's a shift that takes place in people's lives, so that there's a critical mass of people that by 1700, there's enough people, certainly people who are the shakers and movers of the intellectual societies, those who dominate universities, publishing houses, all of that, that are dominated by that second point of view. And they look upon those people who are operating out of that first point of view as being very naive or superstitious, or, boy, those poor people are really dumb, they don't know the truth. People who are operating out of that first point of view are looking at that second point of view going, those poor people, they're just anguishing themselves over nothing. If they only knew the love of the Lord. You know?
Yeah, are we talking about current times here?
Well, yes, we are.
I mean, that's exactly where we
sure
are right
we are.
Now.
That's exactly right. And so this is one of the neat things about studying history, is you go, where did this come from? Well, this is where that came
it's
from.
Back.
Yeah, that's exactly right. And that's where it was in this generation, in the late 1600s, in the late 17th century, that you have this discord within Western thought that's going to lay the foundations for this. And all throughout is going to be what we'll refer to as the modern world.
Mm-hmm.
These are the two elements of the modern world. Now people will look back in 2003 and 2004, look back, and they'll say, that's not even talked about anymore. That's too old. And we're living in what they call a postmodern world.
Right.
And we'll talk a little bit about how that all happens, but just let me give you a real quickie, and then we want to get back into this philosophy. Science, as we'll see, will eventually develop a series of laws that will be immutable.
Mm-hmm.
You know, and certainly Newton is like the guru of all of this. And we're going to see through Newton's law of gravity how all the movement in the universe is explainable. And so there we sort of rest at peace. We know something for sure. Okay?
Mm-hmm.
That's fine until about 1950.
Mm-hmm.
And then through incredible instrumentation, we discover that in fact subatomic particles do not operate by the laws of gravity. Well, wait a minute. What happened to
everything.
The universal law? Because the subatomic particles are also part of everything.
Mm-hmm.
And then when you take it the macrocosmic level, in other words, the highest level of the universe, the great movement of the huge heavenly bodies don't operate by the laws of gravity. What do they operate out of? We don't know. So all we know is that in the middle, gravity operates.
Uh-huh.
The other sides don't. And so if you really take a look at that from a philosophical point of view or a cosmological point of view, you step back and you go, oh, I don't know.
Uh-huh.
And though we find ourselves then thrust back into mystery, which is the first time we've done that in 500 years, because scientific man has always looked and said, oh, science isn't going to figure this out.
Mm-hmm.
So what we have today then is we've got two groups, once mm-hmm. again, and within the scientific community, and one group is going, just be patient. We're using the old methods, and we will find out what's going on here. It's called the unified theory. Eventually, we're going to figure out what this is all about. We're going to find out what it is about light, which is both wave and particle. But, you know, you can't be both, but we'll figure this out. Just give us time, and maybe they might be right. You know, the other group is stepping back, going, wait a minute, there's something much bigger here that is mysterious, is beyond. And all we can see for sure is that this was very intelligently designed.
Mm-hmm.
There is a clockmaker behind this that's done all of this, and he's the big guy.
Uh-huh.
You know, and this is in the scientific community, and it's right. causing lots of arguments, and people are being denied tenure at American universities right now because of this argument.
This is a huge argument right
sure
now.
Sure, it's textbooks, the whole works.
Mm-hmm.
And so...
Finally, it is coming to...
Yes.
acknowledgement, because for many years it seemed like there wasn't any indication that science was showing us that there was someone behind all of it.
Yeah, and I think the reason for that was that the scientific community was being held hostage
mm-hmm.
by mechanical science,
mm-hmm.
Where, well, we'll see this later, and especially in the 19th century, in the early 20th century, there is a sense that we've got this down. Francis Bacon is the guru who gave
mm-hmm.
us the method, and then this method will see us through to the end. However, by the time you get into the 20th century, we discover that there are things that Bacon's method is not able to show.
Right.
And so there is then this group of heretics within the mechanical scientific community who is broken from mechanical science. And when I say mechanical science, I think the highest example of this is evolutionism.
Mm-hmm.
You know, the
mm-hmm.
whole Darwinian concept of things working mechanically through evolution. And it's a much wider, much greater experience, I think, in terms of not so much Darwin, but in terms of that 20th century Jesuit paleontologist, Teilhard de Chardin, as he looks at evolution and says, oh, yeah, mechanical evolution is there, but, oh, it's such a small thing in comparison to the big stuff that's happening,
uh-huh.
you know?
Right.
And I think we're breaking out into all of that.
I
but
agree.
It takes a long way, and this is the grounding, the foundwork for the foundation for what develops in this.
All right.
You know? Well, we're well aware that the medieval synthesis had been abandoned by now,
mm-hmm.
Although, interestingly enough, the medieval synthesis is going to constantly be coming back and reexerting itself as offering good examples and good method. We're talking mainly here about Thomas Aquinas and Aristotelianism, which every so many generations, actually every generation, rediscovers
right.
the beauty as well as the truth within Thomas Aquinas. However, when I'm talking about the medieval synthesis, I'm going beyond that. I'm talking in terms of an embodiment of truth, objective truth, that is put forward, especially in moral and in doctrinal truth, by the magisterium of the Church, and specifically based upon, grounded upon, Scripture and tradition, and then aided by patristics, by the fathers.
Mm-hmm.
This medieval synthesis is going to break down in the mind of people like John Wycliffe, who will be arguing that truth, the question of where truth resides, is basically in Scripture scholars and in individual interpretation. Then we see this breakdown very, very rapidly again. Huss will turn around and say, well, it's truth is found within the church of individual interpreters. Luther backs up a bit and says, well, wait. It's in the Reformed Church, grounded in theologians, especially scripture scholars, but also systematicians like Melanchthon, Calvin, argue with that. No. It's going to be Reformed Church based on my theology, my ecclesiology. Henry VIII, no. It's going to be a national church that will be based on royal authority, controlling the apostolic succession.
Uh-huh.
Come on. And then you're going to have Presbyterians with Knox, then dissenters, Puritans, pilgrims, millenarianists, diggers, Shakers, Quakers, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. Where is objective truth in this? And so we've come to that point, and that's where, when you turn to someone like Francis Bacon, when he begins his writings, people are going to sit up and pay attention, especially since Bacon, right at the very beginning, at the beginning of his writings, announces that his life project is to present the unified theory, the new synthesis. This is going to be the modern synthesis. It's going to be the great revival he speaks of, so that everything can be understood within this Baconian Weltanschauung, this worldview. That's really big, you know, if you're going to be able to do that. As it turns out, he doesn't live long enough. He is able to publish two books, and these two books will set us on the way toward a whole shift in the way we look at reality. Francis Bacon is just... can't be overestimated, the influence that he has on Western mind. Basically, his first volume comes out in 1620.
Okay.
And the title of it is Novum Organum. And what he argues is that everything else that he's going to write must be seen from using inductive reasoning, which is the reverse of everything that's been done, certainly since the Middle Ages, the beginning of the Middle Ages, and most Greek philosophy, which is deductive reasoning. You take a general proposition, you take it as accepted, as universally true, and then from there you deduce knowledge from that using logic. Logic is the method for doing that. And, you know, and we're schooled in that, certainly in our undergrad philosophy. We take logic courses. Mm-hmm. The reason why you take a logic course is in order to be able to use this method of deduction. And we find this, you know, that this method is being used so often by Aristotle uses this method, and Thomas Aquinas, of course, uses this method too. You come up with universal truths and then break down. Give you an example of that. You could ask the question, make the statement, man is a political animal. Okay, now we all accept that.
Okay.
But then what we have to do is we have to, in our process, then our logic process, define what does it mean to be man? What is it to be human? What does it mean to be an animal? How is that? And in what way are humans animals? Okay. And then you ask the next question of political relationships. What is politic? Polis, in the Greek sense of that term. It's a purest sense of that term. We have a rather cynical sense of the term politics and politicians today. But in the purest sense of that, what is that? I understand that Bob Dole just recently had a center established, you know, I believe it's called the Center for Political Studies. He uses that term politics in its purest and Greek sense.
Huh.
You know, the coming together of human beings and how they interact. And so we ask those questions. Well, how should, you see here you enter into moral questions, how should human beings interact?
Right.
You know, so that's all that's done through that deductive process. We can learn a lot. There's tremendous knowledge to be gained by using the deductive process. But Bacon is arguing that because we can no longer, as a civilization, accept the basic propositions, you know, a Catholic will say one thing, and then some Calvinists will jump and say, no, it doesn't mean that. You know, and then, so we don't even accept the basic propositions anymore. And since that system no longer serves us, he argues that instead of arguing down and coming to knowledge, we need to argue up. And so we start at the most basic of levels, and go in the other direction. That's the inductive process. We begin with the particulars. Mm-hmm. We find the general truths from the particulars. Okay. For instance, let's look at the animal kingdom. Okay, not the whole animal kingdom, mm-hmm. but just like let's start looking at certain animals that are mammals. That happen to have four legs and big bushy tails, mm-hmm. okay, and a snout with teeth in it. And we start working along the lines. And eventually we're going to find that there is a very unique species. Let's call them dogs.
Mm-hmm.
Okay. And so we along the way, are able to figure certain things out about the anatomy. And with that too, if you have been around a dog long enough, you know he's got a psychology and a sociology.
Uh-huh.
But we learn so much about dogs,
uh-huh.
you know, through this approach, which we call the scientific approach, because the knowledge is based upon observation,
mm-hmm.
It's based on experience, and it's also based on experiment. And the experiment, of course, the rigor of the experiment is to make sure that you're able to get the same results from the same input time after time. And it's going to be Roger Bacon who is going to cause us to look at the way we gather knowledge from a totally different point of view than what we've done before. We'll see this later on as we see the application of this in the 18th century, in the 1700s, with so many scientific discoveries. First of all, in physics, and then in biology, in geology, in other hard sciences. And then finally, by the 19th century, we'll see this application in what you might call the soft sciences. In economics, political science, and there really the scientific method finds itself breaking down. But that's a whole other story. But the way in which, the way we're looking at this and the way we're going about this, we find this with Francis Bacon being so important. I mentioned also that there was a Frenchman, I think I had mentioned, involved in this, René Descartes.
Mm-hmm.
And he is going to be very, very important too. Because he'll be looking at the demonstration of principles of thought. Again, Descartes is going to step back from using the deductive process and instead take a very unique way of using doubt in an inductive way to build on some knowledge. He's born in France. He's trained by the Jesuits. He has a career in the military, which certainly gives him a unique insight into human nature.
Mm-hmm.
Lives in the Netherlands at a time of great vibrancy among the Dutch. The Dutch have recently thrown off the Spanish, and they now have discovered their own Dutchness, which is very entrepreneurial, very inventive, and very open-minded. You know, sort of like that one steakhouse, no rules, and certainly in thought, no rules. And so Descartes begins with doubt, not with assumptions. And he asks, in a sense, the same question that Montaigne asks.
Mm-hmm.
You know, what do I know? You know, qu'est-ce que c'est? And his answer to that is, well, I don't know anything except. I do know one thing. I know. You know, cogito ergo sum. I know. Therefore, I am. Even if all of reality is nothing more than me dreaming it, the one reality that's real for sure is the dreamer.
Mm-hmm.
And then, so based on doubt, he then begins building upon that. Then, who am I? If I'm the dreamer, mm-hmm. who am I? What's my psychology? What? How do I think? And why do I think? And why do I think these thoughts? You know, do I invent them? Do I invent them from what? You know what I mean?
Yeah.
And so then here he comes. Okay, he comes then to a proof of God's existence, because he's thinking to himself, okay, I know that I exist, and maybe everything else is a dream. But if everything else is a dream, how on earth could I have dreamt up God, which is an absolute beyond me? And if there's an absolute beyond me, then I had to have been instilled with that knowledge. All of a sudden, Descartes is able then to argue a revelation.
Mm-hmm.
He is a voice in the wilderness at the same time that others are denying revelation. He begins arguing revelation based on doubt.
Right.
It's quite unique and exciting. So these are, as we'll go through in the next couple programs, we're going to be looking at really the foundations of modern thought.
Right.
Which has tremendous good to it, at the same time, tremendous pitfalls.
All right. Well, that's great. So we're going to continue the philosophy next week then.
Yes, we're going to be. We'll take another look at some of the things that Bacon did, mm-hmm. especially in his second work, and where his model was going when, unfortunately, he died after the two volumes. We'll take a deeper look at Descartes, and then we'll take a look at some of these skeptics too, Spinoza and others who have rejected these answers and are turning toward another God.
Okay.
Yeah.
Sounds great. Yeah. All right. Shall we close with a prayer?
Sure. Glory be to the Father, and to the Son, and to the Holy Spirit.
As it was in the beginning, is now, and ever shall be, a world without end. Amen. Thank you, Father.
Okay.